Welcome to CISO Interviews, where Affinia hosts cybersecurity executives sharing career advice, actionable insights, and tips so that you can enhance your career and succeed as well.
Adam, thank you so much for taking time for this interview. As we start, can you maybe talk a little bit about your current role and what's in your purview?
Yeah, sure. I'm a Chief Information Security Officer at Yapstone Holdings. We are a payment processor and service provider focused on vacation rent payments and then also expanding into other methods of payments for goods and services globally. I am also responsible, besides enterprise security, I'm also responsible for corporate IT as well as network engineering, which is called our Enterprise Information Technology Services Group
for my organization. It looks like you're wearing quite a few hats, and it looks like there's a lot of areas that you're responsible for. How did you get into cybersecurity? So now we have like the point and the arc. So what's the start of that arc?
Yeah, it's pretty deep arc. I grew up sort of classically in middle Massachusetts, not knowing what I wanted to do when I grew up. Everybody knew that they wanted to be firefighters or doctors and lawyers and police officers. And I had no clue what I wanted to do. I knew what I was interested in, and that was sports, being outside with my friends. I had a Commodore 64 like others did when I was growing up in the mid 70s and screwed around with that. And pulled sort of apart clocks and could never put them back together. But just sort of had that interest. Went to school, went to a small, real small school of 1500, in the middle of Massachusetts as well. Was a biology major for 3 years, needed to get out of that small school as quickly as possible and get a degree. And actually had run into a friend of mine who said, "Well, you're taking all the same classes I am. You must be close to a degree in international business." So I ended up graduating with a degree in international business with a minor in anthropology and Spanish and a concentration in environmental studies, none of which had computer science or any engineering, et cetera. It just meant that I took enough classes. Yeah, I took enough classes.
And what's the path from that?
So then, after college, I worked as a roofer and did some other things that were non-tangential to my degree. And then I get the opportunity to actually work for a friend's family's business that was running a payroll company in the middle of New Hampshire. And I worked with him in doing sales for about a year, made up sales and sales appointments, and ended up traveling through New Hampshire, putting about 40,000 miles on my car, going on fake appointments. And then they started to sort of turn the screws a little bit. And I said, you know what, sales really isn't for me. He gave me an opportunity to be involved in a couple different organizations or groups within his business. I ended up in a manager of information systems for a 3-office, about 70-employee company. That was back when payroll was checks. So it was a lot of managing printer queues in a SCO Unix environment, really just sort of learning trial by fire. My boss ended up leaving to be the CTO of a larger company, and they gave the opportunity to me. So it was a lot of 90-hour-a-week work weeks, just trying to figure things out. Didn't have a staff, so I was supporting desktops as well as a SCO Unix payroll platform and printer queues, network or wide area network in 3 locations. Then I was lucky enough that company was actually purchased by ADP. So that gave me a broader opportunity within ADP Total Source at that point. And I was there for another year or so and ended up being a manager of information systems for a growing company in Boston, who ended up with a footprint in San Francisco. And about 23 years ago, sent me to San Francisco the day after Thanksgiving to look out for office space. Found some office space, built out a 2-story office and a network there. And then 6 months later, sort of in mid-2000, it was the first dot-com crash. And with that, they decided to pull back and wanted me to go back to Boston. And at that point, I already had friends and roommates in San Francisco. So I decided to stay in San Francisco. And lucky enough for me, when 9/11 occurred, I was working for a security company, and we did hard disk encryption and key management. And lucky enough, I say, because the government made a huge spend into a mobile workforce. And with that mobile workforce, they wanted to encrypt their devices. And we were pretty much the only game in town that could deploy in sort of the enterprise scale that they needed. So I ended up working a lot in the federal space, the DOJ, the FBI, the CIA, Drug Enforcement Agency, some others that were in sort of the middle of Pennsylvania and some other strange places. But that really gave me a real better, a much better understanding of sort of enterprise security at a large scale. And worked with a lot of contractors in that space. And that just sort of grew from there. Had the opportunity to sell our product, and I was the director of professional service, so I was running the implementations. And worked with Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo ended up hiring me. A mentor of mine, who was the CISO at the time, ended up hiring me. And I was a single contributor for about 10 years, working on a bunch of high-profile projects, assessing risk, identifying opportunities to identify and reduce that risk, building business cases, being funded for those business cases, building groups, and making it operational. And then spinning off to sort of the next thing. So that went from Wells to Hewlett-Packard, to another forensic company that was doing ransomware forensics right at the height, in the beginning of ransomware. I shouldn't say the height, because the height was probably a year ago, but back a few years ago. And got a taste of forensics and incident response as a consultant, then decided to run back to enterprise because, you know, it's always tough when every time you pick up the phone, someone's, you know, business is burning down, and they don't have access to their data. And then, you know, negotiating with attackers overseas and paying out bitcoins, et cetera. It was really a high stress environment.
I would
Worked
imagine.
well over 100 cases in the 2 years that I was there.
Let's
And went
see.
back to enterprise security. Worked again for a mentor of mine, and then got the job as a CISO. And I had been looking for a CISO. And as they say about CISOs, you can't be a CISO until you are a CISO. So got an opportunity to be the CISO at Yapstone, and took advantage of it, and been there for about two years and 2 months or so.
It's amazing. That's now we've filled all the blanks, so now it's the arc is complete, and it's a pretty unique background from sales to IT to cybersecurity. I think having sat on so many different chairs, it gives you a very unique perspective, a kind of well-rounded perspective on what other departments in the organization are going through, but also, I mean, within your network, you probably see people how they come up through the ranks. And from that vantage point, what would you recommend maybe for some of the more junior professionals? I know cybersecurity as an industry has exploded in scope, understandably so, with technology, with the attack surface increases, and it's kind of always a battle between good guys and the bad guys, but just, I think the battle itself, the scope of it is just increasing pretty dramatically. And I think a lot more and more people are kind of looking to make a career, either switch from IT to cybersecurity, or maybe even college students kind of looking trying to figure out what to do with their life. What would you recommend they spend? What are the top three things they should spend their time on, you think?
This episode is brought to you by Athenia, a community where 2,000 CISOs and other senior executives network, learn, and succeed together. To apply for your complimentary membership, please visit www.afinia.com or click the link in the show notes. Now, back to the show.
Controls can be leveraged to be able to identify, remediate, and mitigate risk. You know, as you were talking about, you know, those that are very analytical and logical and looking for opportunities to be able to leverage that that experience. What I say to them is, you know, start in one area, build subject matter expertise, but be open-minded to the broader scope of cybersecurity. Understand how things are interrelated. You're talking about IT, for instance. I've had many different instances where I've had the opportunity to take IT resources that were being, as staff was being reduced in IT, the spend was being reduced in IT, bringing them over to security as we were building security organizations. And those IT resources that were either supporting from a help desk perspective, or they may be application support, they may be firewall support or an IDS, IPS support, some sort of networking gear. My classic example is like firewall engineers. I was able to take some firewall engineers over and actually show them the process that we use from a security perspective to vet the requests, to be able to identify where those rules should be placed in the prioritization of the firewall rules. And then what we do as the output, which is the command line to provide to them to the, in the ticket. And then what they're doing is executing the ticket on the IT side, typically in larger organizations. All of a sudden, they start to understand, oh, that's why you wanted us to do that way. Or that's why tickets took so long to be able to vet through or to validate through. There was that light that went on and they understood security as it related to the firewall, but they didn't understand the process of what that risk, what the understanding of the risk was and how to best mitigate the risk. And by doing an assessment, right? So that was really sort of the interesting thing. When I look at those that are early stage, again, it's passion, it's logic, it's focus on what they know now and what they can do to spread to spread that out, and then be able to take it on as a subject matter expert. But then to be able to understand the different other pieces of cybersecurity. So if you're working as a developer and you went to college for computer science and you're really interested in development, but not development of applications or development of platforms, more so the development as it relates to DevOps and the development of that code and the deployment of that code or the securing of that code throughout a CI/CD pipeline and the SDLC, et cetera. Right. That's where I can take people that are really great at development, but not really passionate about the development side and really focused on the analytical portion of it and the logical portion of it and push them into product security and how we can leverage tools to be able to identify and assess risk of developed code and then where that actually fits within the CI/CD pipeline. You know, whether it's dropped into dev, whether it's dropped into QA, whether it's dropped into prod, and then what security tools can go along with those as controls to be able to identify and reduce that risk throughout that cycle as well. Those are really the biggest ones. The last one is just to be involved. I think any and all opportunities to be involved in projects, even if it's you're listening in and getting a better understanding, especially sort of at an enterprise scale, to understand, you know, the program management, the project management, the different resources in IT and risk in the development slash engineering side, DevOps, ProdOps, network operations, how all of them combine sort of make up that enterprise technology organization. And sort of where you want to sit within that has really been useful for me. You know, it wasn't until getting to Wells Fargo where I understood how enterprise security actually works and all of the different pieces and different groups that were involved throughout the whole defense in depth as well.
Certainly. And well, I think the point that you made about passion, I think it's very valid because it's easy to get excited about a certain career path or about a certain area, but without this passion, it's really difficult to sustain this. So for someone, and it's certainly, you need to be infinitely curious because the space is changing so much constantly with technology, societal changes, with when COVID pushed everyone to work from home, all of a sudden, to your point, mobile security is so much more prevalent. God knows what my kids are clicking, what kind of links they're clicking on, and what kind of apps they're installing, and it's probably shared network, right? So it's all those things that organizations, enterprise level organizations, never had to deal with. All of a sudden, now it becomes a very important point. And kind of with this theme in mind of this constant change, imagine if you have a crystal ball and you can see into the future and you can see what that landscape, industry landscape or threat landscape is going to look like 12 months from now. From in your view, what are the top three things that will be headaches for CISOs in 1 year's time?
Yeah, I think it's going to continue to be resources. So I think as the economy struggles, I think with that, you're already starting to see the reduction in force that companies are going through right now because of the lack of advertising spends, et cetera. And with that, there's going to be a flooded market. But with that, there's also a constraint of budgets, at least that I've seen. So my issue or challenge is finding the right resources for the right roles and making sure that we are challenging them along the way, and making sure that we understand what their growth potential is and we're helping them along the path of growth so that their time, I'm a small to mid-sized company, their time at Yapstone is full of experience, right? And it's full of opportunities to gather experience and to gain experience. And we're doing some pretty cool things as we're sort of transforming our organization and the technology that we end up leveraging as well. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing.
This episode is brought to you by Athenia, a community where 2,000 CISOs and other senior executives network, learn, and succeed together. To apply for your complimentary membership, please visit www.afinia.com or click the link in the show notes. Now, back to the show.
As we continue to leverage those and they're continuing to leverage other third parties, it's really, really important to understand what that third-party risk looks like and what their supply chain is, to ensure that, that you understand what your risk is. Log4j was sort of a perfect example, and it will still sort of continue. But as you look at Log4j, nobody really knew what Log4j was and what it was embedded in. And it wasn't until the vulnerability scanners got smart enough that you could actually, and they had enough understanding of what they needed to do to provide the feedback, whether they had vulnerable versions of Log4j, did you really get an understanding? Because it may be someone that's announcing that they're running a Log4j vulnerable version that can be exploited, but they're announcing it to someone that you don't even have necessarily have a direct partnership with, right? So you really have to have your ear to the ground to understand what the scope is of the risk and whether you are in scope, and then being able to work internally to identify if you are using any of that vulnerable code in any of your deployments that can be exploited. Right. And then there's service providers, and that's such a layered risk that's there, and that will continue to be the issue. And then I know that for myself, what we continue to struggle with on the IT side is the supply chain. So as we still are moving into the cloud and leveraging cloud-based services, there are still endpoints that users need to use and have access to. So as we are scaling as an organization, our biggest risk globally was delivering the right hardware to the right people at the right time, and then ensuring that we can properly support them in case we need to do a swap, a break fix, that kind of thing. That has continued to be a challenge as the company has forecasted to grow, as most companies have, and then they're hit with the economic reality and may not be growing as fast. You have that large inventory that you may have been stockpiling. Where do you pivot from there? And then when you're pivoting, you're obviously not getting a one-for-one dollar value. So there's just always that risk that I have from an IT perspective that I'm always very, very mindful of as well. So those are really the ones that I see. The last one, which is the fourth one, which I think is on top of mind for a lot of people, is API security. Obviously, the internet is being run, or a lot of the internet traffic is API security these days. Went from HTTP to HBS to API traffic floating through HTTPS. And with that, what you end up seeing is the proliferation of APIs. That goes also go back down to the supply chain and the third-party risk, is that APIs are layered and layered, and you may own your own API, which may go to another company that may be using another API. The risk is how secure are the APIs that you're using, and transferring that data what type of data is in scope for that transfer, what type of regulatory compliance or industry compliance do they adhere to, ensuring that you have a complete understanding of what that risk is. So there's going to be an uptick, I think, even more in IP API security, and organizations are going to invest in
for
that.
For sure. Well, because at the end of the day, it's the chain is as strong as the weakest link, and only takes one, right? It only takes one person clicking on the link. It only takes one vendor, and they, I mean, some of the organizations, I imagine they manage, I know, hundreds, if not thousands, of contracts and vendors of different size, different geography, different cybersecurity posture, different practices, right? So it's, and it's not uniform, it's not unified. So it just the scope of that issue, the supply chain security, third party risk, is mind-boggling for, I guess, for larger organizations specifically, because they have so many more links in the chain. And only one of them can be, if one of them is compromised, that there goes the entire chain. But even for, to your point, for mid-size organizations, if you're relying on cloud providers, even it's a unified interface, if you don't have visibility into their processes and controls, you're relying on them. And sometimes you may be in for a surprise, and certainly, it's certainly to your point, as this trend of moving to the cloud continues, it's probably going to stay highly relevant.
I think the other interesting thing too is that you talk about the good versus bad, and it's not good versus good, but it's something close to that. In that, my job as a CISO is to play not an authoritative role within my organization, but a consultative sort of role within my organization. So the more that I know, the more that I can understand the risk, and the more that I can understand controls that we may need to put in place to be able to identify, mitigate, and remediate that risk. So it's a really big, all of those sort of challenges are really good to talk about internally, because you have, someone in a fraud organization that is using a third party to send customer data or PII data to be able to identify the risk of fraud within a certain transaction. Mm-hmm. And they're using an API If it hasn't gone through a third party risk evaluation within my organization, then we have a blind spot, right? Because we only see it going out as 443 traffic or whatever the case it is, right? They may ask us to open up a firewall rule that's specific from point A to point B. But if we don't have visibility into what that API is or that what that organization is, then we have a blind spot that's there. So very often it's me playing a consultative role and being open. Just come to me and some people within my organization, so that we can understand what you're doing. We're not there to put a roadblock in place, but we are there to understand so that we can actually build the right logging, the right monitoring, the right controls in place to be able to reduce the risk or assess the risk within the organization. So that's really a challenge. Yeah.
For sure. I know, Adam, we're coming up on time. What's the best place to connect? Are you on LinkedIn for someone who kind of wants to reach out and connect?
Yeah, LinkedIn is probably, LinkedIn's probably the best, and it's linkedin.com/Adam-DeMonaco, I think. Yeah, so that's definitely the best way for vendors and peers alike. I've been using your platform about a year now, and just starting to get involved in some more sort of in-person discussions now that not only COVID is sort of loosening up, or I guess we're getting more used to the normal, but kids are back in school and all that stuff. So
absolutely,
get that routine back. Yeah.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for your time. This was lots of fun.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you like this episode, please subscribe to this channel and visit Afinia.com for more information about your complimentary membership, or click the link in the show notes.